or advantages received from any product advertised within this program. Revolution Radio, where information never sleeps.
Fred, could you please turn on your video? Turn on your video.
I need somebody, help. Not just anybody, help. You know I need someone, help. When I was younger, so much younger than today, I never needed anybody's help in any way. Now, but now these days are gone and I'm not so self-assured. Now I find a change of mind and open up the doors.
Well, this is that Jim Fetzer, your host on The Raw Deal, where I'm delighted to have a return engagement by Fred Walker and Mona Montgomery. We're going to be reviewing the history of the conclusion of World War II and all the fabulous claims that were made about the Holocaust. We have a catch here where Fred seems to have checked in twice. So I'm trying to get that minor glitch squared away. Fred, can we see your image? Can you turn on your video and I'll get rid of the extra login? Fred, can you turn on your video?
It's located at the lower left-hand side of the screen.
Lower left-hand side of the screen, Fred. Yeah, there's just going to be the image of a video. It's got a line through it. If you click on it, it'll take off the line and we'll be good to go. Hang on. I do think I see... Fred, can you turn on the video or no? I think I'm going to put one of you into the waiting room. Here we go. Fred, I'm hopeful we can hear you. I want to review the bidding here with the history of World War II. And hope that you will be able to comment. Mona, no doubt, will be able to do so. So we'll proceed on that basis. Here's the World War II official narrative. Is it historical fact or mass illusion? Where I'm delighted to be joined today by Fred Luchter and Mona Montgomery. According to the official narrative, 6 million Jews were exterminated in concentration camps. They were put to death in mass in special gas chambers. The gas they used to kill them, Zyklon B, is a mild form of cyanide. That's the official. We have massive propaganda about Adolf Hitler, who's been vilified perhaps more than any other figure in history, notwithstanding that in the wake of the trial of Versailles, Hitler as chancellor rebuilt Germany to be an economic powerhouse. He did that by securing its borders and by ridding the country of financiers, most of whom were bankers and Jewish, who had been exploiting the financial structure of the government. So to that extent, there is a warrant for claiming that Hitler was opposed to Jews interfering with the government of Germany. The Holocaust has become a kind of religion whose three main components are the extermination, the gas chamber, and 6 million martyrs. According to an article of faith, Hitler ordered and planned the methodical slaughter of all European Jews. In so doing, he committed a crime without precedent, a specific crime later called genocide. And by the way, this is Robert Forasson writing about this, who Robert is among the leading experts among revisionist historians who want to get this right. In order to commit this specific crime, he had a specific weapon developed of mass destruction, the gas chamber, operating with powerful insecticide Zyklon B, whose active ingredient was hydrogen cyanide. The result of this enormous crime was the death of 6 million European Jews. The Auschwitz-Birkenau camp was a focal point, the apogee, the Golgotha of the whore. After the war, the whole propaganda developed around the Holy Trinity of the Holocaust, a whole industry of the Holocaust, a whole business, the Shoah business. In the United States, the film industry has fed this belief and spread it throughout the Western world, especially since 1978. This propaganda has been developed, especially with 4 episodes of the U.S. miniseries Holocaust, recounting the saga of the Weiss family. It's no exaggeration to say the showing of the series began as of 1979, practically mandatory in an entire portion of the world. It triggered a torrent of films, including by Steven Spielberg, Schindler's List, by Roberto Biganini, Life is Beautiful, by Roman Polanski, The Pianist, in France in 1985. Claude Lanzmann honored us with a documentary running for over 9 hours, Shoah. The number of Emmy Awards, Oscars, and other prizes given to films like this is staggering. A mogul of the entertainment industry, Alan Weinstein, once stated in The Hollywood Reporter, let's just say it. The real reason we see so many of these movies is that they're awards bait. It is such observations that have given rise to the saying, there's no business like show a business, inspired by the refrain of the song sung by Liza Minnelli, among others, there's no business like show business. Here's an image of Auschwitz with the rails leading right up to where they were supposed to have been herded off of the boxcars, stripped naked, packed into gas chambers in large numbers, and then gassed. Here's a chart of prisoner markings to identify them, which, of course, one can well imagine would not have been necessary if they were all being exterminated right after the train. The historical revisionists who have made a difference include Robert Forson, whom I've already introduced, Ernst Zundel, Nicholas Kohlerstrom, and Germar Rudolph. Germar's interesting. He was getting a PhD in chemistry when he became interested in the Holocaust, understanding that there were chemical interaction between Zyklon B and the walls that would show up if they'd actually been used in the gas chambers. They should have turned blue. Nick Kohlerstrom has published a brilliant book called Breaking the Spell, building on the reports of meticulous records of the International Committee of the Red Cross, who are keeping documents of the age, the sex, the race, the ethnicity, the religion, and the call of death for all of the inmates, where Nick had the benefit of the British death books because the Brits had cracked the German code and they were keeping copies of all the records. So he was able to verify, based on the British death books, the accuracy of the reports of the International Committee of the Red Cross. And Ernst Zundel, of course, who was put on trial in Canada actually twice. Here's Nick Kohlerstrom, who has degrees from Cambridge and Leuven, who was a member of the staff of the Department of Science and Technology Studies at University College London, until he wrote about the delousing chambers in Germany in World War II and was promptly sacked. Robert Forson has published a great deal, including a wonderful piece against Hollywoodism and revisionism, parts of which I have already shared with you. Among the reasons why Ernst Zundel was vilified was distributing a book that 6 million really die. Among the other experts on the matter is Thomas Dalton, PhD, who has published a book debating the Holocaust, a look at both sides, which is very thorough and well done, and among its points demonstrates there has never been any order discovered attributed to Hitler to bring about the mass extermination of Jews. Nick invited me to write the introduction to his book, Breaking the Spell, which I was very pleased to do. I began with a quote, "The fastest way to get expelled from a British university is by saying you're looking at chemical evidence for how Zyklon was used in World War II, with a discussion of how delousing technology functioned in the World War II labor camps," Nicholas Kohlerstrom. The author of this refreshing scientific study of the Holocaust, Nicholas Kohlerstrom, may be the most honorable man whom I have ever had the pleasure to know. In response to PM David Cameron's denunciation of 7/7 and 9/11 skeptics as on a par with ISIS, he went to Scotland Yard with a copy of his book, Terror on the Tube, third edition, 2011, and turned himself in. Scotland Yard declined the honor, but this act, which symbolically castrated the PM's outrageous stance, was a striking illustration of his ability to tackle a problem by going right at it. The underlying desideratum is whether history is supposed to be accurate and true, or, as Voltaire has put it, merely a pack of lies the living play upon the dead. Just so we know what we're talking about, in its broadest outlines, the Holocaust can be defined by means of its three primary elements, which I shall designate here as hypotheses H1, H2, and H3. H1, that Hitler was attempting to exterminate the Jews and succeeded by putting around 6 million to death. H2, that many of those deaths were brought about by the use of cyanide gas in chambers for that purpose. And H3, that the chemical agent that brought about those deaths was Zyklon B, to which the victims were subjected. The science of the Holocaust does not leave any room for doubt about H2 and H3, insofar as the laws of biochemistry and of material science, laws which cannot be violated and cannot be changed, entail that the bodies of those who are put to death using cyanide turn pink, while the walls of chambers used for that purpose would turn blue. But none of the bodies from those camps have been reported to have been pink. An empirical examination of the gas chambers has determined that, unlike the walls of the delousing chambers, none of them turn blue, which means that H2 and H3 are not simply false, but have been scientifically refuted. Eisenhower had propaganda films produced. Hollywood, as Robert Forreson has observed, plays an important role in shaping public perceptions. Ike brought in director George C. Stevens to Germany to take film. He shot 80,000 feet of film, of which 6,000, 7.5%, was used. The impression was of mass deaths at the concentration camps. Here's part of what Robert has written. Hollywood, along with British cinema and Soviet propaganda, had a terrible and direct responsibility both in the lies attending what was called the discovery of the concentration camps, 1945, and the ignoble lynching party, the phrase of Harlan Fiske Stone, Chief Justice of the U.S. Supreme Court at the time, that the Nuremberg trial of 1945-46, where the winners of the war and coalition made themselves judge and jury to try the defeated. It's altogether true that in 1945, even a privileged concentration camp like that of Bergen-Belsen offered a nightmarish vision. But the horrors discovered there were not created by the Germans. They were due to the war, and in particular an air war conducted mercilessly to the end by the Allies against civilians. It took a fine cynicism to show those horrors and point an accusing finger at the defeated, when the ones mainly responsible were the U.S. Air Force and the Royal Air Force. In April of 1945, no longer able to manage, the Commandant of Bergen-Belsen, SS Captain Joseph Kramer, sent some men to meet the advancing troops of British Marshal Montgomery and warned them they were approaching a terrible den of infection, that they should not immediately release the prisoners lest they contaminate the civilian population and the British soldiers. The British agreed to work with the Wehrmacht. Once on site, they kept the detainees there and tried to treat them, but mortality remained appallingly high for a long time. The British wanted to know how many inmates were buried in the mass graves. They extricated the corpses and counted them, then using a bulldozer, a British officer pushed the bodies toward six large ditches where the soldiers forced female SS guards to cast them in with their bare hands. This was very soon transformed by the film propaganda services, which had people believe the bodies were those killed in the alleged extermination program. A photograph taken from a plane and showing the bulldozer from afar made it possible to convey the impression the vehicle was driven by a German soldier performing his daily work as an employee of a death factory. In one case, a photo taken from up close showed the bottom of the machine pushing corpses, but beheaded the driver so that with him not appearing as a Brit, he was reckoned to be a German. The Americans went on to make more and more falsifications of this kind. The American General Eisenhower, Supreme Allied Commander, was also the impresario of this intensified Hollywoodism. The famous Hollywood film director George C. Stevens was brought to Germany in the uniform of a lieutenant colonel. His team shot 80,000 feet of film, from which 6,000 or 7.5% of the total were selected for General William Donovan, Special Assistant to the U.S. Chief of Counsel at Nuremberg. It was those parts, carefully selected by the American prosecution, which, on November 29, 1945, practically at the lifting of the curtain of the loathsome Nuremberg trial, were projected to a stupefied world. Some of the German defendants, most disturbed at what they saw, deduced that Hitler had carried out a gigantic crime behind their backs. In this sense, it can be said that the Nuremberg trial marked the triumph of Hollywoodism, which was using Hollywood to promote propaganda on behalf of the West and to absolve them of their guilt for bombing the German cities so massively, leading to mass starvation. Here you see indications of some of the bombing. It was simply overwhelming, and may I say, bombing of civilian cities is a war crime. This was committed by the Allies, and it interdicted the railroad camps so that the Germans were unable to resupply the prison camps and keep them alive. There's much more to be said, but let me get some comments and responses from Mona and Fred, if I am so fortunate. Fred, are we in contact? Can you hear? Can you speak? Mona, pick up the slack, my dear. Give us your thoughts of what I've covered so far.
Well, the three elements of the myth that I notice are the gas chambers, the 6 million figure, and the factory-like extermination program. And of these three, our guest, Fred Lucher, is the expert on the gas chambers. He was an expert who testified in the trial of Ernst Zundel in Canada, who Ernst Zundel ran afoul of the Canadian.
Hello.
Wherever he went.
Well, I'm delighted to say we now have Fred joining us by phone. Fred, give us your comments and what you have been able to follow of what I've been presenting so far.
I haven't heard much of anything. The voice has all been jumbled, and Mona was cutting in and out. I haven't heard a thing.
Okay. Well, I was given a summary overview of World War II, the official narrative, including that ostensibly 6 million Jews were exterminated, put to death in gas chambers using Zyklon B, how Hitler was massively demonized, how the Hollywood has participated with a series of film promoting the idea of the official narrative, how we have plenty of photographs of Auschwitz, we have charts about the insignia the prisoners were required to wear, how there are historical revisionists who've made major contributions, including Robert Forreson, Ernst Zundel, Nick Kullerstrom, and Germar Rudolf, where Nick holds degrees from Cambridge and London, was sacked from his position at the Department of Science and Technology Studies at the University College London for investigating what had actually happened, the way in which Zyklon B was used as a disinfectant. Robert Forreson has published about Hollywoodism and revisionism and how the whole film business was manipulated. I was explaining how Nick invited me to write the introduction to his book, and where I began with a quote from Nick: the fastest way to get expelled from a British university is by saying you're looking at chemical evidence for how Zyklon was used in World War II, with a discussion of how delousing technology functioned in the German World War II labor camps, where Nick may be the most honorable man whom I've ever known, how I reduced to the three propositions, hypothesis H1, H2, and H3 for the Holocaust in a narrow sense, to wit, that H1, Hitler was attempting to exterminate the Jews and succeeded by putting around 6 million to death. H2, many of those deaths were brought about by the use of cyanide gas in chambers. And H3, the chemical agent that brought about those deaths was Zyklon B. The science of the Holocaust doesn't leave any room for doubt about H2 and H3, insofar as the laws of biochemistry and of material science, laws that cannot be violated and cannot be changed, entail that the bodies of those put to death using cyanide turn pink, while the walls of chambers used for that purpose turn blue. But none of the bodies from those camps has been reported to have been pink, An empirical examination of the gas chambers has determined that, unlike the walls of the delousing chambers, none of them turn blue, which means that H2 and H3 are not simply false, but have been scientifically refuted. How Eisenhower had propaganda films reduced, Hollywood played an important role in shaping public perception. That he brought in director George C. Stevens to Germany to take film. He shot 80,000 feet, of which 6,000 or 7.5% was used. The impression was of mass death at the concentration camp, which they attributed to the Germans, but actually was an effect of the Allied bombing of the German cities, which also interdicted the railroad line so that it was impossible to resupply the camps with food. And that's the overview we've been addressing here so far, Fred, on which you are most welcome to comment at length.
Well, basically, the conduct of the Allies, and particularly the British, during World War II, and this is the same conduct that was employed during World War I, has been just totally anti-German. Bletchley Park was the location that was responsible. It was the British Dirty Tricks Department, and they were the ones that came up with the idea of the 6 million Jews being murdered with hydrogen cyanide gas, which was totally untrue. And it's gone beyond that, because it was picked up after the war by the Jews and by the Israelis, and it's turned into a multi-billion-dollar operation in money, in equipment, in everything. The German government has been supplying money and equipment to the Israelis for years. The United States has. It's just been totally impossible, and it was a lie that was started by the British. So the bottom line here is that this was just a deliberately orchestrated mess that was created by the British, and it only means that the British government is something or someone, if you will, that cannot be trusted, because they have a history of doing things the way they've done this during after World War II. Between that, 1945, and now, they've totally destroyed the German psyche. Germany is in a total mess because the three generations of people are confused and they're ashamed to be Germans. On top of that,
I hope to kill the break, but apparently it hasn't happened. So we'll be right back with Fred Lochter and Mona Montgomery after this break.
Hey Fred, hi Mona. Hey Jim.
Hello.
My back door into the PC took a little longer than I anticipated. I see Jim ran to the to the bathroom.
Okay.
To take his break. So where were you at? Where were you, Fred, talking?
I was talking about the mess that was created by Bletchley Park, which is the British Dirty Tricks Department, and they've created a problem that has totally destroyed the German psyche today. The Germans are confused. They don't even know whether they're Germans. They don't want to be Germans. They're ashamed of themselves. And even when the Germans believed that there was no Holocaust, if they believed that there was no mass murder, they're still confused and they don't like themselves. So, I mean, it's just plain terrible. But at any rate, do you have any idea what's happened here? Why I couldn't
get on?
Well,
I'm waiting for Jim. Jim took a quick break. He was expecting the break to be a few minutes long, and it took me a little longer than I thought to get into the back door of the studio. You know, you're making so much sense, and there's a parallel that we see today that society in the United States is taught effectively about slavery the same way that the Germans have been taught to have German shame, that the same psychological tools are essentially being used here in the United States to create this racial divide that we're in.
Yes, I agree.
If that makes sense.
It's a total mess. And it's deliberate. You know, the British are good at that. Of course, the British government has, there's a lot of Jewish control there, and there has been for years. But the British are particularly good at it. Look what they did to Ireland. For 700 years, they tried to conquer Ireland, and all they did was manage to expand the area they controlled, which was called the Pale. It got larger and smaller and larger and smaller, depending upon the number of soldiers that they deployed in Ireland. And then they got the bright idea, let's colonize Northern Ireland, which they did. And they've created this problem where people think it's a Catholic Protestant war, and it isn't. It's still the same war that originally existed, the British Irish War. The Brits are still trying to conquer Ireland, but what they did was very insidious, because they've mixed their families, they've mixed the British blood with the Irish blood, and they caused the Irish to fight themselves. And the British government is never to be trusted any place. Here in the United States, we found that out during the American Revolution when they locked Boston down and tried to starve us out. That was before the Revolution, and then the Revolution finally occurred after that. But the point is, the way the British fight is terrible, and they should be ashamed of themselves. I'm not complaining about the British people. I'm complaining about the British government, and that's probably because there are Jews that are controlling it.
Well, I think that's right, Fred. And, you know, the Russians have even an expert on their defense board said the first target is not going to be Warsaw or Prague. It's going to be London. If Russia has to respond to all this Western nonsense about Ukraine and all the sanctions, London will be the first center. Just as Muammar Gaddafi observed so many years ago, if you want to end terrorism around the world, just lob a cruise missile into the city of London.
Yes, that's probably true. The problem is that you're going to kill a lot of people, and what you really want to do is kill the people that are causing the issue.
Yes.
I don't think the average Brit knows what the hell's going on.
Right, right, right. Well, listen, we have much more to cover, and I'm just delighted we finally made contact. And my apologies to our listeners. There was an extra button I had to click that I failed to do. So here we are back on schedule. So the question becomes, did 6 million Jews really die? There are 236 references to 6 million in dire straits or fear of loss of their life before the Nuremberg tribunals. They begin as early as 1890 and have no historical or empirical basis. They appear to be based upon a disputed passage of Leviticus, but even that requires interpolation because there was no term in the original Hebrew for 6 million. Get this. 236 references to 6 million Jews. They're all over the place in the international press. Here's one from an American Zionist leader, Rabbi Stephen Wise, in 1900. Let's flip the Zionist agenda behind the Holocaust hoax to promote public sympathy for Zionism and the takeover by the Jews of Palestine. In his address, he said, there are 6 million living, bleeding, suffering arguments in favor of Zionism. The 10th edition of the Encyclopedia Britannica of 1902. 6 million Jews in Europe are in trouble. 1905, a Jewish preacher declares that if the Jewish-led communist uprising in Russia succeeds in its longtime goal of overthrowing the Tsarist government, Zionism would be obsolete. 6 million Jews is mentioned again. 1906, a Jewish publicist addressed an audience in Germany claiming the Russian government had a solution of the Jewish question, which entailed the murderous extermination of 6 million Jews. Of course, the Russians had no such plan, but the fictional story was resurrected during World War II with the Germans on the receiving end of these slanderous accusations. Here's another. 1921, Chicago Tribune begs America save 6 million in Russia. Russia's 6 million Jews are facing extermination. Here's another. 6 million victims notice, 5 to 6 million. This was on January 9th of 1938 in the New York Times. It appears that all this is predicated not on history, not on evidence, but rather on a prophecy from a disputed passage of Leviticus that claims that the chosen people may return to the promised land only when they're minus 6 million who have been consumed in the flames, but where even that requires interpolation because, as I observed in the original Hebrew, there was no word for 6 million. The historical record, moreover, suggests otherwise. The International Committee of the Red Cross kept meticulous records. They originally concluded a total of 279,310 had died from all causes. They recalibrated their total in 1993 and arrived at a combined deaths of 296,081, none of whom died from being put to death in a gas chamber. Here you have the original report, Fred can't see it, Mona can, of the International Committee of the Red Cross. Here's more. For years, Jews have told people around the world 6 million were systematically murdered in German concentration camps during World War II. Anyone disputing the claim has been viciously smeared as a hateful anti-Semite. Countries around the world have even jailed people for disputing the claim 6 million were killed. Here now for all the world to see is a scanned image of the official International Red Cross document proving the so-called Holocaust never happened. Jews around the world intentionally lied for the purpose of gaining emotional and business advantage for themselves. They committed willful criminal fraud upon millions around the world. To the extent to which the number of Jews who died in the camps can be objectively determined, the most reliable numbers appear to come from the records of the International Committee of the Red Cross. Not one is reported to have been put to death in a gas chamber. The total in 1993, as I mentioned, 296,081. Even rounding up to an even 600,000 gypsies, Jews, mentally and physically infirm. The empirical evidence contradicts the contention that 6 million Jews were put to death, and thereby falsifies hypothesis H1. Counting deaths attributed to the Holocaust, apart from the records of the International Committee of the Red Cross, turns out to be an exercise in fuzzy math, because none of them add up. As Forasson observed during an interview on 13 December 2006, the Yad Vashem database was built up by simple unverified declarations emanating from unverified sources, processed in such a way one and the same person could be recorded as having died several times, in some instances many as 10. And even the most complete archives are not collated to make the total number accessible, but only individual cases, which appears an obvious measure to preserve the untestability of H1, the hypothesis that 6 million Jews had perished. The International Committee of Red Cross in World War II really played a very important role, but we now have museums all over the world that are promoting the myth that 6 million died by being put to death in gas chambers using Zyklon B. And here, enter Fred. There were no gas chambers. The trial of Bert Zundel was sensational on multiple grounds. No, not one witness was produced to testify for the prosecution at the first trial. Fred looked or testified. No suitable facilities existed in Germany during the second or at the camps. Germar Rudolph has confirmed the use of Zyklon B for delousing, but not for putting them to death. Where Robert Forasson has a wonderful piece on the Zundel trials 1985 and 1988. where he talks about the failure of the prosecution in the first trial of 1985 to produce a single witness who could testify to seeing anyone put to death in a gas chamber. And then in 1988, where the Luchter report was introduced, Fred, you made here your historic debut.
Yes. You don't imagine that since the Jews, they came from the ghetto and they brought with them the lice that were killed in the delousing chambers. There perhaps may have been more than 6 billion lice killed. You don't imagine the Jewish lice are being considered by the Jews as being Jewish, do you?
Nice point. Might have been 6 million lice, but not 6 million human beings.
Right. But if they were Jewish, maybe that's the 6 million Jews.
That's very, very sardonic humor there, Fred. I'm just so pleased that you are recruited to undertake this objective scientific study of the facilities that were alleged to have been gas chambers and found none of them could possibly have served that purpose. In other words, it was technically impossible to have put to death individuals in gas chambers when there were no facilities that could properly have functioned as gas chambers.
And even if we do have the facilities to do it right, we cannot do more than two or three at a time. So it's, you know, what they talk about is just impossible.
Yes.
And the amount of hydrogen cyanide gas that would be necessary to kill 6 billion Jews never existed in the history of this planet.
That's another nice point. They didn't even have the supply of cyanide necessary to perform this massive feat.
Yeah, and that amount of hydrogen cyanide gas has never even existed from the time that hydrogen cyanide was discovered or invented until today. So that amount has never existed ever. I mean, that's an awful lot of gas.
Yes. And doing it at two or three at a time and the amount of time it would take, this would have extended over, 20 years or more?
It would have taken a hell of a lot more time than that. I know when I spoke in Washington at one of the meetings, I pointed out that if in order to cremate 6 million people, we would have still been doing the cremations in the mid-1990s. So I would assume the Allies would have had to take all these corpses and help the Germans cremate them. Because, I mean, that's how long it would even take to cremate them, let alone kill them.
Yes. The story is ridiculous on multiple objective and scientific grounds. The technology didn't exist. They didn't have the resources in terms of cyanide. He couldn't have put to death more than two or three at a time. The energy and the resources required for cremation would have meant it went on for decade after decade after decade. All excellent points. Mona, would you like to offer some further thoughts of yours?
Yeah, also, when Fred was working with these machines, these gas, whatever you call them, gas chambers, the men could only kill one or two or three inmates. But to let people understand what a gas chamber looks like, it looks like a big, maybe an oversized refrigerator, about the size of maybe three refrigerators, and it has a very heavy door like a refrigerator has, and it has a big gasket like your refrigerator has. It has to be airtight. So when he went to look at the alleged gas chambers, he was looking at a giant morgue with a wooden door. They were not hermetically sealed, even if it had been possible, even if it were possible to create a huge gas chamber of that size. You have to at least have a door on it, like at least as good as a refrigerator door. And all they had was this wooden door that opened from the inside. So there was no way they could keep the gas in, even if they did have the
Zyklon.
That's
right.
So, That's one thing I wanted to remind everybody, and I just think it's interesting that they got Lucher to do the testimony because he was the top expert in the United States, and then he went over there and he saw no gas chambers. He just saw this big morgue. I think he says it had it used to be an armory where it kept a bunch of bullets. In fact, Auschwitz was a military camp where they kept, I think it's about 100 or 200,000 soldiers in those big long barracks that you see. And so, of course, they had to have a morgue because they had, you know, people die when you got that massive number. But it's just even the average person looking at what they say is a gas chamber, once they see what a gas chamber is actually is and how it has to be this hermetically sealed big metal construction, the average person knows that you couldn't have ever made a gas chamber out of those things they're telling us were gas chambers.
Fred, more about your observations and visits to these various camps.
Yes, well, no matter where I went, and you know, I looked at facilities also in Germany and in Austria. I looked at Hartheim Castle in Linz. I looked at Mauthausen. And of course, none of the gas chambers were considered to have existed outside of Poland. Even though at one time they said that, all of the gas chambers that were outside of the Iron Curtain were investigated by a British doctor. He was attached to the British Army Medical Corps. His name was Dr. Barton, and he was sent to each one of the camps to verify whether or not there were gas chambers there and people had ever been gassed. And this shows you how Bletchley Park kept their stuff separate from the rest of the people, because the rest of the German military didn't even realize that it was a made-up story and a hoax. But the point is, he went from camp to camp to camp, and he sent all his letters back, all his reports back, went back to the British military, and he says, no gas chambers here, no gas chambers here, no gas chambers here. And then after two or three years, all of his reports had been suppressed, and he had to sue the British government under what we would call in the United States a Freedom of Information lawsuit to get his reports released. That was in 1951. And as I say, here, they did try to verify all this, and they did verify it, that none of it ever happened. Now, the problem was that even when after this was done, the Jews turned around and said, well, he didn't look at the gas chambers in Poland because he couldn't get in there. And that's exactly right, because the Iron Curtain was blocking anybody from the West from coming in. And for years, it behooved the Russians to say that the gas chambers were real and that they were in Poland, because Stalin wanted to make himself look better than the Germans. So he blamed the Germans for all this mass genocide when he was doing it himself with the pogroms in Russia. But at any rate, when the Iron Curtain fell, that's when I went. Everything seemed to just fall into place. I guess it was time for the world to know that these mass murders never occurred.
Yes.
And the Iron Curtain came down. I went in, and I stood in the middle of the gas chamber, or the alleged gas chamber, and I said, where the hell is it? And it just wasn't. So, I mean, that was my remark, and I was a little annoyed when I was standing in the alleged gas chamber at Kreml 1, because I said, I'm an expert. I was brought over here to certify whether or not these things were gas chambers for the court. I don't like to waste my time with this foolishness. This is a joke. And that's the way I felt. They had no right to do that. But it was necessary, because it was time for the world to finally find out that this was just a big hoax, a myth, and a lie.
And Fred, you thereby ensured your place in history. Let me continue with some more of what we have discovered. Here's a floor drain in the morgue at Crema 1 at Auschwitz, close to the current access to the furnace room. In addition, it has two toilet drains, two manholes, so they were probably added in 1944 when the building was converted to an air raid shelter. Here you have the 26-year-old Germar Rudolph inspecting a Birkenau delousing chamber. Notice the wall has an intense blue hue. Meanwhile, we have inside of one of the four Dagesh delousing chambers, as it can be seen today at Dachau. At the top, the can opener controlled from the outside. The Zyklon pellet slid through the pipe into a wire mesh basket at the bottom, through which warm air was conducted by the heater fan unit. This is a contrivance to attempt to make it look as though there were bona fide gas chambers. Just ahead, a few more observations before I return to Fred. The facilities are inconsistent with death camps. The Auschwitz map shows a concert hall, working shop, swimming pool, more strikingly, hospital and surgical unit equipped with OBGYN facilities. Hundreds of children were born at these centers for extermination. There were organized sports and a British soccer team at Auschwitz, which may be my favorite photograph. Here you see all the barracks and so forth, as Mona was observing. This was formerly a military camp. You had a hospital with a surgical unit, obstetrical, gynecological block, quarantine areas, woodworking shops, a brothel. They even had a brothel, an art museum, a library. They had an orchestra playing in a symphony hall. I mean, it goes on and on. Meanwhile, we have photographs of children being liberated from the Buchenwald camp, who appear to be relaxed, well-fed, and trusting of the adults around them. Here's another of the healthy-looking children at Birkenau being liberated by the Red Army. Here's a British football team, the British soccer team at Auschwitz. I love this photograph. If you want a single refutation, what, you didn't know there was a British soccer team at Auschwitz? I put it on the back of my book, and I suppose we didn't go to the moon either, which includes not only refutation of the claims that we went to the moon, but discussion of the death and replacement of Paul McCartney by an even better musician, of the first death of Saddam Hussein, who was replaced by a body double to be put on trial, the death of Osama bin Laden, which happened on 15 December 2001, where 10 years later, Barack Obama resurrected him to have him die a second time in a compound in Pakistan to position himself for a triumphal reelection as the man who got the most wanted man in the world, where Osama actually was an officer in the CIA. He was our man in Afghanistan. He was instrumental in getting Stinger missiles into the hands of the Mujahideen and had nothing to do with 9/11. And then a series of essays by Thomas Dalton, Robert Forreson, Nick Kohlerstrom, and myself about the Holocaust, which I believe is exactly the reason that Amazon banned the book. The six of my books to be banned by Amazon were the ADL requested that Amazon ban any book that disputed the official narrative of the Holocaust, and they banned between 200 and 2,000 books. I mean, Fred, this is so outrageous. This is so un-American, and I have... You know, they're essentially operating as an instrument of the state.
Oh, yeah, there's absolutely no question about it. I mean, one thing we can do, we can sit back and feel very comfortable about the fact that they're totally afraid of us. When they have to go to Amazon and ask Amazon to ban your book, they're afraid of you.
Yes.
Can you imagine you got all these people afraid of you?
They're afraid of the truth. They're afraid of the truth, which shows them to be liars and phonies and frauds and manipulators and propagandists and purveyors of disinformation, Fred. They fear exposure, so they want to suppress any source that would run them that risk, which my books do again and again, where I bring together groups of experts to figure out what really happened on these occasions, like Sandy Hook, the Boston bombing, Orlando and Dallas, Charlottesville, Parkland, and even the moon landing, really, the Holocaust.
Right. Yes.
They did this to Fred, and Fred can tell you about it. After he exposed the gas chamber myth in, I guess, around 1993 or whenever the Zundel trial was, he suddenly went from being this highly paid expert in the military field producing these cameras and things. He couldn't get a job after that. No matter where he went to get a job, they'd call the employer, make sure he couldn't work. And so he ended up doing menial jobs. I mean, they weren't. Well, for instance, he ends up managing wherever he's doing anything. But he was hired, I think, as a bus driver or something for a halfway house. I mean, you know, low level jobs. He couldn't be rich anymore. He had to be poor.
Yeah, yeah. After the trial in 1988 and Fred's report was released, it was devastating to the official narratives, and that's how they play the game. They go after to punish anyone. They've gone after me to punish me. They have brought lawsuits that have led to a 1.1 million plus judgment against me. And now they're trying to take my book, Nobody Died at Sandy Hook, and even my blog by way of the domain names, even though I own none of the above. I mean, it's outrageous how they weaponize the law to enforce and punish those who risk exposing them as phonies, frauds, and liars. Fred, I'm so sympathetic that you've suffered these inequities by being a good citizen and speaking the truth as you know it to be based on your objective and scientific research of these camps.
Yes, well, you know, the funny thing is I guess I expected too much. And Zundel kept asking me if they had come after me yet, and it took about 4 or 5 months before they mobilized to come after me. And I never thought that was going to happen because I, you know, an expert witness that works in the court system is much the same as a legislator, as an attorney. These people are supposed to be exempt from outside pressure at all times. You're not supposed to be able to attack legislators for what they say on the floor of the legislature when they're debating bills, because they're running the government. It's important. There should be no outside influence. There should be no outside influence on anybody that's part of the working of the government that have to deal with these special problems. But it didn't make any difference. They came after me, and I guess I was in a special case because I said things that shouldn't have been said.
Well, stand by. We're hitting another break. We'll be right back with Fred Luchter and Mona Montgomery.
Was it a conspiracy? Did you know that the police in Boston were broadcasting, "This is a drill, this is a drill," on bullhorns during the marathon? That the Boston Globe was tweeting that a demonstration bomb would be set off during the marathon for the benefit of bomb squad activities? And that one would be set off in 1 minute in front of the library, which happened as the Globe had announced. Peering through the smoke, you could see bodies with missing arms and legs. But there was no blood. The blood only showed up later and came out of a tube. They used amputee actors and a studio-quality smoke machine. Don't let yourself be played. Check out And Nobody Died in Boston Either. Available at moonrockbooks.com. That's moonrockbooks.com.
If you think for 1 second that the Capitol will ever treat us fairly, you are lying to yourselves. Because we know who they are and what they do. This is what they do, and we must fight back. You can torture us and bomb us, fire. melting. And if we burn, you burn with us.
Good evening.
Are you awake yet? I hope. We've tried and we've tried for years and years to use passive resistance and loud voices to make a change. The time is over. Your governments around the world have no other goal than to decimate your entire existence. At the hands of the bankers and the elites. The war is coming, and it's your choice to decide if you want to be a warrior or a victim. Denial is not a choice anymore. Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com, the number one listener-supported radio station on the planet. Not giving up. Revolution Radio.
Amazon banned my book so you wouldn't learn what really happened at Sandy Hook. It was a FEMA drill presented as mass murder to promote gun control. Then they sued to shut me up, and the Wisconsin courts played along. I have the proof and the law on my side. What I don't have is the money. They want to do to us what they've already done to Canada. Take guns, impose tyranny. It's on the way with Remington's help. First insurance, then registration, then confiscation. I'm asking SCOTUS to stop it. Give SendGo.com funding Fetzer. Check it out. This is for all the marbles.
The opinions expressed on this radio station, its programs, and its website by the hosts, guests, and call-in listeners or chatters are solely the opinions of the original source who expressed them. They do not necessarily represent the opinions of Revolution Radio and FreedomSlips.com, its staff, or affiliates. You're listening to Revolution Radio, FreedomSlips.com, 100% listener-supported radio, and now we return you to your host.
Well, I'm overjoyed to be back again with Fred Luchter and Montgomery reviewing the Holocaust, the official record, and how it's been falsified for political purposes, and where the British played a crucial role in all of this. Let me add a few more observations, which those who watch the video review of this will be, I think, like a great deal. Why they must maintain the myth. The Holocaust narrative has been used to justify founding Israel. Israelis worry about that exposing the fantasy would weaken them politically. The expansion of Israel has continued unabated since its founding. They continue to harass and kill Palestinians on virtually every day. Here you can look at a map of the disappearing Palestine, where in 1946, virtually the entire area was controlled by Palestine. Then the UN plan of 47 shrunk it by at least 50%. 49 to 67, further reduction to maybe 20%. By 2012, less than, I'd say, 5%. Meanwhile, the Israelis order Palestinian-owned water wells to be closed. This is back in May of 2020. This is outrageous. Israeli settlers poisoned Palestinian wheat fields in the Jordan Valley. This is another typical act of the Israelis to punish and harass the Palestinians, where I'm convinced the final solution from the point of view of the Israelis would be to load all the Palestinians aboard a ship, float it out to sea, and sink it. Palestinians devastated after Israeli settlers destroyed their olive trees. This was 27 February 2020. Israel's planned annexation of the Jordan Valley and why it matters. Any Israeli move to annex parts of the occupied West Bank could effectively kill remaining hopes for a two-state solution. Netanyahu says Palestinians in annexed land will not be offered Israeli citizenship. Residents in the Jordan Valley will live in isolated communities under Israeli security control, but under Palestinian Authority rule, the prime minister says. In other words, they're going to be in what, along with Gaza, is the world's largest concentration camp. We know, though, of the Israeli plan to export its borders to the greater Israel from the Tigris-Euphrates to the Nile, the two blue lines on the Israeli flag, which takes a big chunk of Egypt, all of Jordan, all of Lebanon, a big chunk of Saudi Arabia, about half of Iraq, and two-thirds of Syria. This is the Israeli agenda. And we know, of course, historically, they've engaged in acts of terrorism since the bombing of the King David Hotel on 22 July 1946, where Menachem Begin led a gang of urgent terrorists dressed as Arabs, killing 91 and injuring 45. And then, lest we forget, on 9 July 1967, Israeli jets attacked the American spy ship, the USS Liberty, killing 34 of the crew, wounding 171. But the ship did not sink. Fred, I know you're familiar with a whole lot of this, as is Mona. Your thoughts about the broader political agenda within which the Holocaust narrative plays an indispensable role as a propaganda motif.
Well,
Fred, have we got you there?
Yeah, I'm here. Mona. I thought I lost you.
We're here, Fred.
One comment I'd like to make, which shows you that that what these people do is just totally ludicrous. As you said, they banned your book, right?
Yeah.
They've also banned my report. And why anybody would ban an official court document doesn't make any sense.
Court records are supposed to be public. That's part of it. We have public proceedings to implement the law so the public can see how the law is operating in specific cases. That's just outrageous.
Yes. I mean, I don't care because I don't make anything from it, so I get no income. But I mean, the point, they're building something that's a matter of public record. It's stupidity. If I wrote a book that said there were no gas chambers, I can understand them doing that because they say, well, we're going to shut down his income. But what's the point of banning a public record and court testimony? It just doesn't make any sense. It's just censorship for the sake of censorship.
Yes, yes, absolutely correct. Mona, your thoughts?
But no, it's not. It's censorship for the sake of establishing a religion, the religion of Zionism, which was started by Theodore Herzl, right, in my opinion, in response to the invention of the internal combustion machine, which suddenly made oil important, which it never was before. So this brilliant Jewish guy, Theodore Herzl, comes up with an idea. Let's see, how can we get all that oil? God has to give it to us. And he went to the Bible and he found this scripture that says something about the chosen people. We get to have all the land between the Nile and the Euphrates, and he made it a religion. And it's now being promoted by our government, which is not supposed to establish a religion, but it's clearly a religion. You're a heretic if you dispute it. You go to jail. In Fred's case, his house was actually firebombed, and the son of his wife was injured. He got some facial injury from it. I'm just saying that this is crazy religious zealotry that supports this myth, which is the basis of which is to get all the oil for the Jews. It's very rational. It's not irrational at all when you see what they get out of it.
Yes, yes, so, yes. Fred, further thoughts. Go ahead, Mona.
One more point is that the complete fraud of creating Israel was Israel was created on the premise that we were going to put an end to war because the atomic weapons had become too dangerous. We couldn't play around with these tribal wars anymore because we were going to blow everybody up. So it, at that time, when the United Nations was working on creating a peaceful world, they said, well, these Jews have to have their own land. So like the graphic that Jim put up shows, they were given a portion of the so-called Holy Land. And then Jerusalem was established to be a comfortable place for all the three great Abrahamic religions to enjoy as their capital, the Jews, the Muslims, and the Christians. What a beautiful idea. But the Jews completely, they never meant it. They accepted the land on the basis of world peace, but they immediately started these aggressive wars against the Arabs. And against Eisenhower's Adams for Peace plan, we gave them the nuclear material, the scientific know-how, and the money to have wonderful nuclear energy throughout the whole land. Everyone would have free lights. And instead, in complete opposition to what they promised, they start building nuclear bombs, which in my opinion is why they had to kill Kennedy, because he found out about it and he was threatening to dismantle them, and poof, he's assassinated. So what I'm saying is, this whole thing of Zionism is predicated on the greed of wanting to get a hold of the oil. They lie, cheat, and steal to get it. They make fun of all of our most humane principles like world peace. They don't mean a thing they say, just like our fathers told us in the 40s. These communists lie.
Yes, yes. I mean, it's indispensable. And moreover, Zionism, as the Talmud reflects, entitles Jews to lie to other non-Jews. That is their right, because they are the superior race, and they are as superior to the other human races who exist only to serve the Jew, as the human races collectively are superior to the animals in the field. Menachem Begin was very explicit about that, but we have a whole string of similar sentiments from many of the prime ministers of Israel. And Bibi Netanyahu is very blatant about exploiting America to benefit the Jew, that they're going to suck America dry, turn it into the world's largest welfare state so it can die on the vine, because that's what we do with nations we hate. And yet the American people naively believe that Israel is our friend. Israel is our enemy. Israel wants to use and exploit the United States for the benefit of Israel, and to hell with the consequences for Americans. They could care less. Fred.
Yes, I agree. That's 100%. And as I've said before, most people don't realize it, and I think they've kept it pretty quiet as much as they could. But thanks to Clinton and his wife, the United States supplied Israel with all kinds of nuclear material, and Israel now has nuclear missiles pointed at every capital city on the planet. And if they go down in a fight with the Muslims, or a fight with them in the Middle East, they're going to take the entire planet out. And people don't realize how ruthless they are.
The Samson option. Remember how Samson brought down the temple? The Israelis threatened to bring down the entire world if they don't get their way. They've been very blatant about it. My understanding is they have nuclear weapons stationed in embassies all over the world, and they've been able to bring them in diplomatic pouches that could not be, under international laws of diplomacy, inspected in order to create this. Now, I've also been given to understand, but cannot verify, that those weapons have been neutralized, but have no doubt about it. That has been a plan of the Israelis, to which they refer, as I mentioned already, the Samson option. Mona.
Oh, you got me by surprise. The Samson option, the Liberty, the reason the Liberty ship was there surveilling Israel was because they had heard some rumblings coming because the Israelis attacked the Arabs in Egypt, which has gone down in history as the poor Israelis being attacked on four fronts by four different countries, and they wonderfully, miraculously, with God's help, were able to put down all five of these attacking countries, when in fact it was the Israelis that were attacking the five countries, including Egypt, This was, I think, 1967. I'm not sure. And so the Israelis were attacking the Egyptians, and they rounded up 1,000 Arabs from Egypt and marched them out to the desert and started shooting them. And the Liberty ship found out about it, or they knew something was coming. So they drifted from the east of Africa to the Mediterranean, and they started watching the Israelis. The Israelis didn't want to be watched because they were already putting out propaganda about how they were being attacked. So they decided to attack the USS Liberty, which they did. And it's a heroic story about the place covered with blood, and I think there were 177 deaths. And the guys heroically crawl up the mast and put up the flag. The American flag. They think the Jews don't know that it's the Americans. They say, "Oh, you, my friend, don't shoot me." So the Israelis shoot down the American flag, and then the sailors go up with a bigger American flag, a great big giant one, and they say, "Oh, you misunderstand. We are the Americans. You don't want to." Boom! They shoot them down. Then they take a torpedo and they smash it into the side of the thing, and it really is like a miracle story. The ship just moves around. All the guys are dying, but the ship doesn't sink, and I think that there's a Russian ship or somebody that comes over and saves them and rescues them. And then the sailors are told that if they dare ever say anything about this, worse will happen to them than that they will die. So they're all threatened and muzzled. So no revenge is taken for the attack of this surveillance ship, of which we only had two at that time. That was before we have satellites. So these were our state-of-the-art surveillance equipment. One has just been destroyed. We got one left, the USS Pueblo. And guess what happens to the USS Pueblo? The Asian guys are saying, well, they don't do anything. They don't do anything if we attack their ship. So they attacked the USS Pueblo. And they took our sailors on board and they tortured them. And that wouldn't have happened if we had taken proper action against the USS Liberty. I don't think that the Asians would have been emboldened to take the USS Pueblo. So it actually cost us two surveillance ships.
Well, let me add a few thoughts about this. I've done a fair amount, and I have a friend even more. Lyndon Johnson had the Liberty move from off the coast of Africa to off the coast of Egypt, where they would conduct surveillance. The Israelis were supposed to sink it and blame it on Egypt to justify U.S. intervention in the war. Moshe Dayan was such a brilliant general, he mopped everything up. In the 6 days war, they didn't need us. But Lyndon Johnson was intent that the Liberty should wind up at the bottom of the sea. We even have the transcript of the Israeli pilots with their commanding control saying this is an American ship and they're ordered to go ahead and attack it anyway. So this was perfidy by Lyndon Johnson, who was a scurrilous guy, and he was the mastermind behind the assassination of JFK. There were multiple parties who wanted Jack out and Lyndon in, primarily for policy reasons, including Israel, as you correctly observed, because JFK was at loggerheads with David Ben-Gurion, who is the first prime minister and a founder of Israel, who wanted the Israelis to have nuclear weapons when Jack opposed on the ground it would begin a nuclear arms race in the Middle East. And as I understand it, his last act as prime minister was to assign the Mossad to participate in the assassination and resigned in disgust. And of the eight shooters we have, one appears to be an Israeli shooter representing the Bronfans out of Toronto. But we have others representing other parties. We have an Air Force expert representing the military. We have a CIA shooter representing the CIA. We even have Lyndon Johnson's personal hitman. We have an anti-Castro Cuban. We have a Dallas deputy sheriff. We have a Dallas cop tied with the CIA. I mean, there were multiple sponsors, and each appears to have put up their own shooter in Dallas, where Edward Lansdale appears to have arranged the location of the shooters and the sequence of shots under the supervision on the scene of George Herbert Walker Bush. This is a terrible story about which I've done massive research. Fred, your thoughts on all of the above?
Well, one of the things I wanted to point out, too, that the U.S. military did respond to the attack on the Liberty. The command for that area was out of Tokyo, and the admiral in Tokyo, who had the responsibility, sent elements of the Air Force to aid the Liberty, but they were turned back by Johnson, by direct order. And
that's right. That's right. That was- Lyndon Johnson called back American planes coming to the aid of the Liberty. This was a grotesque act of treason by Lyndon Baines Johnson. Outrageous.
Very definitely. And you know, he should have been ashamed of himself. But again, he was a tool of the Jews. And the whole purpose of that, they wanted to make sure that the Liberty didn't send out the information, because that was their big coup. They were going to take Jerusalem, and they did. Their great friend who supported them in the Middle East, King Hussein in Jordan, was being stabbed in the back because they took a hunk of his country. They took Jerusalem away from him, and he was the one that kept Jerusalem an international city where all religions could be practiced without any problem.
I just want to add a few more slides before we come to the break, and then we'll open the lines for callers. How Menachem Begin claimed the Ergun saw the hotel solely as a military building and therefore a legitimate target. Begin claimed three warnings were sent out on July 22nd of 1946 about the planned attack. The warnings were to no avail. The British did not evacuate. The bombing killed 91 and injured 45. Few in the hotel itself were killed, and Jews were among the casualties. The USS Liberty incident of 1967 was a combined air and sea attack by Israeli defense forces during the Six-Day War, where we have discovered what happened there. But Lyndon Johnson's administration did not interfere when notified the attack was in progress. Both the Israeli and U.S. governments have officially treated it as a case of mistaken identity, but it was anything but. The Liberty attempt, of course, is described in Wikipedia as having been a mistake, where the Israel apologized for the attack as an error, being mistaken for an Egyptian ship, but they knew better, as I've explained. Here they're claiming it was this Egyptian ship, which has a completely different configuration than the USS Liberty. Plus, as I've observed, the Liberty was flying the American flag. The Liberty was flying the American flag, and where there was no question about the identity, they were directed to go ahead and attack the ship, even though they knew it was American. Fred, further thoughts?
Yeah, if my understanding is correct, the commander of the strike force from Israel that was attacking the Liberty reported back, and he said something to the effect that we can't attack this. This is a ship with a flag of an ally, the United States, and he was ordered to do it anyway. And he refused to do it. And I understand that he was later court-martialed and sentenced to 21 years in prison for refusing to attack the American ship. So
yes.
They
yes.
Keep that stuff pretty much secret, but it does leak out. And
assuming you and Mona are open, we're going to invite callers after the next break. The number 540-352-4452, 540-352-4452. Fred, I'm sure many would like to speak to you, especially given your historic role in the Ernst Sundell trial and what you have done to expose the truth about the massive fraud known as the Holocaust. And, of course, none of us, neither Mona nor you nor I, deny that in a broader, more nebulous sense, World War II was a Holocaust. Millions die. It was a great atrocity. Probably none lost more of their population than Russia, which may have lost as many as 20 million from the German assault, but the Russian winter did them in and eventually led to the defeat of the Nazi war machine. I'd invite your comments, Fred, on this before we hit the break.
Yeah, well, the Russian winter is particularly difficult to deal with because Napoleon wound up with the same problem. He wasn't defeated by the Russians. He was defeated by the weather. And Hitler had the same problem. Once he got bogged down at Stalingrad, the handwriting was on the wall, because the Russian weather is enough to destroy anybody. And the you know, like everything else, the Russians take credit for that, but the siege of Stalingrad and the cause for the German failure was not fighting the Russian military. It was strictly a matter of fighting Mother Nature.
Yes, that's right. That's right. And it's really rather surprising that given that Napoleon had encountered this problem, that Hitler would replicate the disaster that he incurred. It's surprising because Hitler was a pretty astute military strategist, all things considered.
Yeah, but I guess they got bogged down because there were mud conditions that were not normal in Stalingrad, and they were unable to get up. They were unable to continue into Russia, and that left them in a position to be destroyed by the winter.
Yes.
And I don't think anybody could have foreseen that the conditions there were going to be that bad, so that they couldn't get up. I think had they known that, I don't think Hitler would have advanced at that point. But I mean, Hitler was also trying to make a political point to the Russians, because the Russians were an ally of Germany, and then suddenly they turned around and became an ally of the Allies. They allied with the United States, they were a bunch of turncoats. That was the problem, and I think he was making an effort to show that you don't get away with that crap.
Yes. Let me reaffirm after the break we're taking your calls. The number is 540-352-4452. Mona, Fred, and I are here to listen to what you have to say. Any comments or questions we may have, I observe we already have a caller standing by. We'll take him right after this break. So we have a second or two. Mona, would you like to squeeze in a word here before we hit the break?
Yeah, about gun confiscation. Everybody knows you need the right to defend yourself, and everybody knows you need the right to defend yourself against an oppressive government. But the real important thing that nobody talks about is that if you have a armed populace, that's what you need to defend a foreign attack. And that all these countries like Afghanistan that have an armed people, we can't defeat Afghanistan. Nobody can, because you can bomb to get down there. But once you get down there and you're on the ground, it's you guys against the other guys. And if the other guys are armed, you don't win. You cannot get that kind of country. That's the kind of country our founding fathers wanted us to be. And we have to do that, or we're going to be invaded by a foreign country.
Yeah.
Radio at freedomslips.com, and we'll be right back after this message.
Management would like to take a moment to thank the listeners and hosts for all their support that has made Revolution Radio one of the biggest platforms for free speech in an ever-growing dark world of censorship. Unfortunately, this platform for free speech has never been free. We need the support of the people. It is the people like you, yes, you, that keeps the station in the front lines of the battle against tyranny and oppression. Please help support Revolution Radio so free speech will not be silenced in a world that seems to be going deaf to the real truth. With your support, we will be able to become an even bigger pillar of light in a dark world.
Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com, the number one listener-supported radio station on the planet. Revolution Radio.
Join Revolution Radio every Wednesday, 8 p.m. Eastern Time on Studio B for Momentary Zen with host Zen Garcia at freedomslips.com, the People Station.
Even the government admits that 9/11 was a conspiracy. But did you know that it was an inside job, that Osama had nothing to do with it? That the Twin Towers were blown apart by a sophisticated arrangement of mini or micro nukes? That Building 7 collapsed 7 hours later because of explosives planted in the building? Barry Jennings was there. He heard them go off and felt himself stepping over dead people. The U.S. Geological Survey conducted studies of dust gathered from 35 locations in Lower Manhattan and found elements that would not have been there had this not been a nuclear event. Ironically, that means the government's own evidence contradicts the government's official position. 9/11 was brought to us compliments of the CIA, the neocons, and the Department of Defense, and the Mossad. Don't let yourself be played. Read America Nuked on 9/11. Available at moonrockbooks.com. That's moonrockbooks.com.
The opinions expressed on this radio station, its programs, and its website by the hosts, guests, and call-in listeners or chatters are solely the opinions of the original source who expressed them. They do not necessarily represent the opinions of Revolution Radio and freedomslips.com, its staff, or affiliates. You're listening to Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com, 100% listener-supported radio, and now we return you to your host.
Well, we have our first caller from the 816 area code, Brian. I believe you're in Texas. Join the conversation, Brian.
You always get it wrong. It's Missouri.
Okay. Missouri. Okay, Brian, fair enough.
That's okay. When you were talking about the Liberty, you really triggered a memory for me. I know we've all heard of the Nixon tapes, but what's much more interesting is the Johnson tapes. Excuse me. They used to be on the internet, and you know, when you read the raw data, you really get what's going on. And what I remember on the Johnson tapes was it was, I think, June 6, 1967. The Israeli ambassador was shown into the Oval Office, and McNamara and Johnson are in there, and on the tapes, the Israeli ambassador announces to Johnson, he says, "You've got a spy ship off our coast. We're going to sink it and we're going to kill everyone on board." This is on the tapes. And McNamara and Johnson say, "You can't do that. Are you crazy? That's insane." And so they're really giving him hell. And then the Israeli ambassador says to him, "You forget. We control your press." And then it got quiet. And then Johnson said, "Well, go ahead and do it." And, you know, I've never heard anyone anywhere uncovering that. But, you know, when you get the raw data, you really get the truth before you get any spin. And then it triggered another memory. That I think it was in 1973, Ladies Home Journal had a article by Lyndon Johnson's mistress, and she talked about before the Kennedy assassination how Angleton from CIA, Nixon and Johnson both met at her place, and they were discussing the upcoming assassination of Kennedy. And so, you know, I put that in my memory banks, and I understood why the Israeli ambassador said, "We control your press." So anyway, that's what I had.
Well, let me invite Fred and Mona's comments. Fred, you're first.
Well, I'm not familiar with the tapes, and I had never heard that before. but I can certainly understand it. I can understand the Israeli attitude. They think they run this country, and the attack on the Liberty was a military incident, and Johnson should have let the military deal with it. And the military would have dealt with it quite well. I think they would have stopped the attack. They would have destroyed the people, the aircraft that did do the attack, and it probably would have ended there. But Johnson backed down and stopped the protection of our soldiers. And the problem is, what good is the military when you put them out on the end of a limb, and then you don't protect them?
Yes.
When something occurs, our military is out fighting for us. They have to be protected first.
Yes, yes, yes.
And there's no excuse for what happened there. I don't care who did what. The attacking force should have been totally disabled and destroyed.
Yes.
Then we can, when the smoke clears, we can sort out what happened. But right now, it doesn't matter whose flag was painted on the side of the aircraft. The only thing that matters is the aircraft be destroyed.
Yes, yes, yes.
We have a responsibility to our military people to do that. If we don't, why should anybody be in our military and fight for us?
Yes, yes, yes. I think that's correct. Mona, your thoughts.
Just that I think that that's true. I don't think anyone should get into the military, and especially because in today's world, with all this technology we have, I don't see any real purpose in having a military, because the problems that used to be solved by force can now be solved by logic. There's no need for force anymore. So we should just make it as obsolete as they tried to make it back when they established Israel, and face the fact we don't need to be beating each other up and destroying the environment and blowing up the planet and killing people. It's become totally absurd. It's not like tribal war is proving who's the biggest, strongest man that can preserve their genes. It's just not happening. It's just craziness.
Well, you certainly are an idealist, Mona. I mean, I appreciate anyone who believes that morality and reason are going to prevail in today's world really hasn't quite taken the pill yet, I gotta say, but I love it. I mean, you know, in an ideal, in a perfect world, that would be the case. Now, I've got several questions for Brian about what he's had to say. If he's talking about Linda's mistress, I presume he's talking about Madeline Duncan Brown, with whom he began an affair in 1948, bore a son, Stephen, in 1950. I've had over 100 conversations with Madeline Duncan Brown. I've read her book, Texas in the Morning. I've never heard the story that Brian is relating in relation to this event at her home, presumably. In fact, Madeline was rather floored by the whole event. She was present at the home of Clint Murchison Sr. the night before, where J. Edgar was there, John J. McCloy, a host of other heavy hitters, disappeared into a boardroom when Lyndon appeared unexpectedly late in the evening. After 15 or 20 minutes, he came up, strode over toward her. She expected he'd whisper sweet nothing in her ear. Instead, he told her in a hateful tone of voice that after tomorrow, he wasn't going to have to put up with the embarrassment from those Kennedy boys any longer. That's not a threat. That's a promise. He even called her again the following day and repeated the same message, even as the assassination was about to take place, where 6 weeks later, on New Year's Eve, during a rendezvous at the Driscoll Hotel, she confronted him with rumors rampant in Dallas at the time that he'd been involved, since no one stood to gain more personally. And Lyndon blew up at her and told her the CIA and the oil boys had decided that Jack had to be taken out. So, Brian, I would invite you to expand more. I and the tape, that's fascinating. Where do you come across that tape? Because I, like Fred, have never heard that tape before. Tell us more.
Well, you know, this was the golden age of the internet, probably 11, 12 years ago that I read this. And the same with Johnson's mistress. I read all this on the internet, and I just remembered it all. But I don't, for the life of me, because it was so long ago, I don't remember her name. And it just fit with other things, because there was an incident where Johnson was in the Oval Office looking out, and there were black people outside just, you know, raising hell. And so he's just going on a tirade of, you know, racial epitaphs and just going crazy. And Andrew Young walked by the Oval Office and heard it. And he said, well, yeah, I forgive him. I know it's not him because he gave us our civil rights movement, but that's not really true. What I kind of figured out is when Johnson was meeting the CIA or whatever, that one of the things they were told that he had to do was the civil rights movement. That was one of the things they wanted when they made him president, because Eisenhower tried to have a civil rights movement with enforcement when he was in office, and it was Johnson who nixed it. It was killed in the Senate by Lyndon Johnson. So, you know, all these things kind of make sense. So I think that was one of the things he wanted, but
listen,
go on. I'm sorry.
JFK wanted to pass the Civil Rights Act, and Lyndon put him off and put him off and put him off, said the time was not right, because Lyndon wanted to do it when he was president, and he boasted he'd have the blacks voting Democrat for the next 100 years after passing the Civil Rights Act. But that was part of his grand strategy to take out Jack. On 22 November 1963, there was a vote to take place in the Senate on the Bobby Baker scandal, where Bobby had been Lyndon's bag man in the Senate, and it was widely speculated he would be so tarnished he couldn't run with Jack again. But JFK had already decided he was not going to run with Lyndon. He'd already confided in Evelyn Lincoln, his personal secretary. He was thinking about Terry Sanford of North Carolina as running mate. Lyndon was hysterical that he might go to jail. So, I mean, the motivation for getting rid of Jack, and even on that very day, this was all organized, orchestrated. Lyndon arranged for him to go. He even sent his chief administrative assistant, Cliff Carter, down to Dallas to make sure all the arrangements were in place for the assassination. We have another caller standing by, Michael from North Carolina. Michael, please join the conversation.
Hey, greetings, guys. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, good. I want to go back to, at the end of the last half hour, you guys went into Operation Barbarossa and the reason for, I don't know if you got to the reason per se, but the invasion of Russia by Germany in June of 1941.
Yes, go ahead.
I had a couple of comments about that, because I think the reason for that whole event, it is on the same scale as the historical deception of the Holocaust. That's your overall topic today. If you go back to that time, it's quite well known now, although it's not, you won't find this on the History Channel. You know, they turned the invasion of Russia by the Bolsheviks into the Russian Revolution, right? That's a huge deception right there. And then the fact that the giant Jewish banking houses in the West were totally behind communism, and at the time, there were literally violent communist revolutionary movements happening all over Europe. They were not at all shy about announcing their intent to literally take over the world with communist ideology. And it started with violence. And we'd had at that point 30 years or 25 anyway, to see, the Europeans had seen what that ideology had done to Russia. So I don't think it was ever Hitler's intent. Every invasion, including the French invasion, was a counterattack to prevent from being attacked. And at the time that June of 41 came around, the United States and the Western powers had been building up Russia with military equipment for, I don't know, before the war started even. And they were amassing, Stalin was amassing a gigantic invasion force on just the other side of Poland. And they had some, I don't remember the numbers, but it was like a massive number of tanks and men, but they weren't ready to invade yet. They were getting ready to, but this massive force was preparing to roll all the way to the English Channel across Europe. And I think the primary motivation of Adolf Hitler was on a larger scale. He knew what Bolshevik communism was all about. And they'd been fighting it there in Germany as well, as you know. And he did not want these wars with other people of his kind and ideology and Christian cultures. He tried heavily to have peace between Germany and the other Europeans. So he left what he thought would be a good defensive force along the lines that were fighting at the time, and threw everything to try to destroy Soviet communism. And I think why he was actually trying to save Europe and European culture from the biggest threat that it faced at that time, and that was Soviet communism.
That's rather fascinating, Michael. Fred, would you like to comment?
I think Hitler was looking at the total picture on everything. But like everything else, he had to deal with each situation as it came up. Hitler didn't want war, period. He just wanted back what was Germany's. He wanted to put Germany back together after it had been dismembered by the Treaty of Versailles. So I mean, his total picture was here. I want to put Germany back together again, but I don't want to fight anybody foreign. But he wasn't going to get that by Churchill. So you know, I agree. He was looking at a total picture, but his motives were entirely to make Germany whole again.
Well, that's true. But
can I comment?
Hang on, Brian. Go ahead, Michael. Okay. I'll bring Brian back. Go ahead. Go ahead, Michael.
I was just going to say, yes, what Fred just said, and it's an honor to talk to you, Fred, is correct. But when he was faced with this situation of this buildup of the Soviet army that was so huge, they were the Germans, when they invaded in Barbarossa, they were outnumbered 3-1, both in personnel and tanks. But they launched a quick attack before the Russians could figure out what was going on. And so they routed them all the way to Stalingrad. And then, like you say, it was the winter that did them in.
Yeah, very good. Brian wants to squeeze a word in. Brian, go ahead.
Yeah, what he's referring to, there was a book that came out after the fall of the Soviet Union by Viktor Sororo. He's a Russian general, I think. And he talked about exactly what Michael's talking about, that opening phase of the Battle of Barbarossa, as they called it, was actually a meeting engagement. And you really take the casualties of equipment and personnel when you've got a meeting engagement and one of the sides engaging isn't ready for it. And so they weren't ready, just like he said. And he's right, too, when he talks about how horrendous these communist groups were in Eastern Europe, you know, before all this, and Hitler was aware of it. There's a unit called the Aragis, an SS commander, Aragis, A-R-A-J-A-S, who was tasked with shadowing a communist pedophile cell in Latvia. And they were following these guys, and finally they saw him with a small boy going into a building. And so they raided it, and they were mutilating this boy, and they said they were getting ready to sacrifice him to Moloch. And they said, you SS or Amaleks, and I don't even know what that means. And then they said this boy was going to be exsanguinated, and I don't even know what that word means. I didn't want to look it up, but there was pamphlets in this talking about how they were going to destroy the Aryans, the blonde-haired, blue-eyed people. They were going to propagandize us out of existence. And if that didn't work, they were going to flood Europe with black males and breed us out of existence. And, you know, what triggered all this was a guy that was in this SS Aurigis unit. His grandson was told all this, and when the Pizzagate thing happened, it was triggered. And you can actually read the article on Henry Macau. And if you just punch in that A-R-A-J-A-S word for this SS commander, it goes into detail, and it talks about how they were just killing these evil people. So, you know, and of course Hitler knew about all this. So this was when the SS was good.
Excuse me. Before we run out of time, we're getting short now. I want to plug three excellent alt history books that have a whole lot more truth in them than practically anything you'll see. The first is called The Myth of German Villainy by Benton Bradbury. And the second is by the prolific author Frank Joseph, also writes a lot of alternative history, and it's called World War II Turning Points. That's the one that specifically addresses the reasons and what happened in Operation Barbarossa. And the third is a book that was written by one of our colleague grandfathers, who was a Englishman named Colonel J. Cray Scott. And it's called The Hidden Government from 1954. And it really integrates everything that was known at that time about the whole Jewish movement in the world and how it became the communist movement, and how they knew, and this was right after World War II, and how these things figured in together to create this tension between communism and Christian culture.
Well, Michael, I want to thank you and Brian both for excellent calls. I want to ask Fred to offer his thoughts and Mona as well. Perhaps I'll start with you, Mona. You haven't had a chance to get a word in edgewise. Go ahead. Your thoughts.
Okay. This exsanguinated means draining of the blood. And what was going on there was they were sacrificing their kid in a blood ritual sacrifice, which, by the way, Jesus put it into. Thank you, Jesus. And what they did is they do, like they do to cows, they hang them upside down and they get all the blood out of them, and then they burn them on their altars and they have a big party. But they also like to do it to kids. So that's what was going on. There's a couple of historical notations of this. The St. Stephen is one guy that they caught the Jews doing this to, and there's been a couple others. As of 15 years ago, Hal Turner pointed out that they had found the bodies of five kids stuffed in a sewer in Russia, and they had been exsanguinated, which suggests some of those people are still doing those things.
Very, very telling. Fred, your thoughts?
Yeah, well, I don't know that my thoughts are going to be much different than anybody else's. I mean, obviously this stuff shouldn't be happening. Obviously it is happening, and these people think that they're going to get away with it. They get away with it in the short term, but they're not going to get away with it in the long term, in the overall picture. And Mona's exactly right. They're hanging these people or children upside down, and they're sticking them in the neck, and they're letting them bleed out. And I believe they also use the blood, so I would even consider these people to be vampires of sorts. But at any rate, yeah, I mean, I don't know if I can make any more comment. I don't think anybody thinks this is proper and should be conducted, but it is.
Yes. No, I think it continues in relation to what's known as Pizzagate, which is the American franchise of Pedogate. Hillary Clinton, Huma Amigan, John Podesta, Nancy Pelosi have all been implicated in Pizzagate, which involves terrorizing children so the adrenochrome flows into their blood and then killing them to drink their blood because it purportedly keeps them looking youthful. This is something in which both Hillary and Huma and by inference both Podesta and Pelosi have been involved. I've done a fair amount on this. Go to jamesfetzer.org and look for jimtheconspiracyguy.com, the 65 shows, and scroll down to Pizzagate, Real or Illusion, and you'll learn more than you ever wanted to know about this horrific practice where even Barack Obama has been implicated in WikiLeaks releases. There's one that Obama spent $65,000 flying pizza and hot dogs in from Chicago for a private party at the White House. The White House doesn't accept food from outside sources. It turns out that if you were flying real pizza and real hot dogs from Chicago, they'd be inedible by the time they got to Washington, D.C. But in pedo slang, hot dog means little boys, pizza little girls. So Barack Obama spent $65,000 of taxpayer dollars to fly little boys and little girls in from Chicago for a private party at the White House. This is a caliber of disgusting individuals we've had running our government. And let me point out, the Democrats are extending this. Nancy Pelosi is still exerting her lurid and foul influence, including managing the whole January 6th event after Donald Trump had authorized on the 4th of January 20,000 National Guard troops to ensure that there were no protests, which Pelosi and Schumer and the mayor of Washington rejected because they had another plan in mind. It was infiltrated with FBI, the Capitol Police, the Speaker of the House is in charge of Capitol Police. They were all complicit in this effort to tarnish Trump and his followers with a phony claim of instigating an insurrection. It's all nonsense. And now they brought in a witness who is speaking third hand about things he doesn't know and touting it as though it were an historic day. Well, what really was an historic day was when Fred Lochner's report was released in the Ernst Sundell trial of 1988. And I cannot applaud him enough for having the courage and integrity to speak out to join me today. Mona Montgomery, Fred Lochner, I hail you both. I think you're wonderful, and I'm so delighted you could join me today.
Well, thank you.
My great pleasure. Voting for excellence.
Thank you for listening to Revolution Radio.
Enter into a world unseen on Raven Star's Witching Hour. You will encounter eclectic topics from the realm of spirit brought into our matrix of truth. With your host, the Solaris Blue Raven, Solaris will bring you an array of unique guests covering topics from ghostly spirits to amazing anomalies, covert technology, UFOs, and shadowy global events.
And that's right here at Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com, Saturdays, midnight till 2 a.m. Eastern Time. Revolution Radio, where information never sleeps.
Let the magic rise.
This is Thomas, a.k.a. a Mad Painter. I'd like you to join me Monday nights, 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time for Open Canvas. Don't forget to bring an open mind.
Yes, folks, that's right. Bring an open mind to an open canvas. Again, that is Monday nights, 10 p.m. Eastern. UFOs to government corruption. This is Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com. You don't need to expect us. We're already here.
we did not engage in conflict that was out of line with our mission.
Is it disloyal? Is it sedition? Is it treason to oppose the hands of tyranny? Never!
I will never send troops anywhere on a mission of that kind without telling them that if somebody shoots at them, they can darn well shoot back.
I know not what course others may take, but as for me, give me liberty! Oh, give me!
A dark cloud is finally lifting across the world as U.S. military intelligence...